Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob is one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world. His most recent book, I believe from last summer, Zoom, How Everything Moves. It is available all over the world, and Bob is a great guest for making complicated things seem easy. And that's what we like here on this program. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org, or you can go to our Facebook page, WAMC Radio, and look for the Vox Pop post there. Or you can tweet us at WAMC Radio. Just use the hashtag VoxPop. But the number, once again, is 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back.
Great to be here, Ray.
You know, those two bright things up in the sky, they're quite mesmerizing up there right now.
They're really cool. What are they?
Well, they're planets, right?
Planets?
Yeah. Those two things that are very close together at night when you look up in the clear sky.
I know.
I'm okay.
Just acting dumb. Yeah, Venus
also
and
a flying start.
You know, it's been cloudy generally here in the Northeast, and it's too bad for the closest approach, which was on Tuesday, but it's still around. If it's clear tonight, which it might be, they're pulling apart. But there's Venus, just about at its brightest now, bright enough to cast shadows. And when the moon leaves us another few nights, it won't be out. You can actually see your shadow by Venus light. And then there's Jupiter, the other one. So that's really cool.
They're very close together in the sky.
They were on Tuesday, and now each night they're pulling apart.
Yeah. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I'm sure it happens. I'm sure you can calculate how often this sort of thing happens. But I don't recall in recent memory those two appearing so close in the sky.
Yeah, very cool. A third of a degree. That's like less than a moon width. That was really nice.
And then the other big news, well, there's plenty of big news, but the New Horizons spaceship getting close to Pluto, sort of close.
It is. And, of course, we've waited now 9 years for it. It was the fastest ever spacecraft to leave Earth in January of 2006, been traveling all that time. And now we're going to, for the first time, we already are, getting images of Pluto, and anything we learn is new because Pluto's so far away and so tiny. It's only 1,400 miles in diameter, which means two-thirds the size of our moon.
Yeah.
It's smaller than our moon. So, and it's not an it, it's a they. There's two of them. So there's a double body. Back when it was a planet,
it had a moon, but it wasn't that. Now it's not a moon.
Exactly. Now it's a double dwarf planet. So the other one is Charon. You'll hear a lot of announcers say Charon, but it's Charon. Pronounced
okay.
Charon. So Pluto and Charon, and the images that are already coming in, and we're still, you know, we've still got a while to go because it's going to be Tuesday morning after this Tuesday, that is the 14th, Bastille Day, at about 8 in the morning that we get our closest approach. The spacecraft can't stop. It's going 8 miles a second. It can't slow down. It doesn't have a means to go into orbit, so it's just going to speed by. So for about half an hour, we're going to have the closest approach. So the cameras will be frantically taking pictures. It'll be too busy to send us anything until the next day.
Ah.
And then the next day we'll be able to see the close approach. But even now, ahead of time, we're seeing weird things on Pluto. Wouldn't you know it, that it would prove to be so weird? In particular, it's a very bright white planet, but it's got these black, almost perfectly round spots, same size, evenly spaced, like drops of ink.
Huh.
And it's too bad this is going to be on the side of Pluto facing away from the New Horizons spacecraft when it passes by. But no matter, between now and then, we'll get closer and closer pictures of it. So it's very exciting. I mean, and we're going to have the controversy reignited about whether it deserves to be a planet or whether demoting it was a good idea.
And when we launched this spacecraft, it was still a planet, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, funny. So we've got a spacecraft going towards one type of object, a planet, and then arriving at a different kind of object, a dwarf planet. And if we actually explain to everybody the reasons for demoting it, I'll bet people would be more willing to come around to the anti-planet viewpoint. As it stands, I think the reasons that the public is so upset is, number one, everyone likes the name Pluto.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't named after Walt Disney's cartoon dog. The dog was named a year after the planet was discovered in 1930. The dog was actually Rover in its first cartoon. It's Disney's only non-speaking character.
The things you know, it's quite amazing.
And then a year later, Walt Disney's folks decided to exploit the popularity of this new planet, and so they changed the name to Pluto. So that's how it became that. But everybody likes Pluto. No one cares about Uranus. It's the butt of jokes. But because because this one is Pluto, I think people are upset. And also, I found over the years that most people, Ray, only have one science astronomy number in their minds. You know, astronomy is all numbers, the diameter of the moon, the distance of the Earth to the sun. It's all numbers. But if you ask people any of these things, how large is the moon? How far away is it? What's the size of the sun? Most folks don't know these things, but they knew one thing. The public knew how many planets there were. You could ask anybody, number of planets, people would say 9. So to pull that away from them and say, no, we're going to change that. The only thing you know about astronomy, we're going to change that and make that wrong.
Well, it's easier now. One less. You know.
Right.
But, I mean, how many planetoids? That's a better question.
That's right.
And there are hundreds?
Well, there's 10,000 known planetoids, which, for the people listening in, we could call them planetoids, we could call them minor planets, we could call them asteroids. So there are a lot of different names for that category also.
Well, okay, here's one, and we'll get to the phones in a minute. I apologize to those waiting. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Here's one that came in via email that pertains to planetoids, and this is from Susan in New Lebanon. So what do you think about those bright spots on Ceres? What are they? And have they changed at all since they were first noticed? Are there similar spots on moons or planets elsewhere?
Yeah, it was really strange because it was so bright and there were so few of them. There's one major one and then a minor one. And it was almost as if Ceres, and maybe this is the case, had ice under the surface under a darker, polluted, weathered surface. And then a meteor came in and exposed.
Brushed it clean.
So that's maybe the most likely.
But we still don't know yet.
No, because we only had that one visit. Ceres also is spherical. So here you got the regular planets, and then you have two round bodies in the solar system, really, Ceres and Pluto.
Now, comparing size, Ceres to Pluto.
They're about the same size. Pluto's 1,400 miles in diameter. Ceres is, actually half the size. Ceres is closer to 600. So I take that back. Ceres is closer to the diameter of Charon, Pluto's moon, mm-hmm. if we can still call it a moon, of a dwarf planet.
Now, I as I understand it, the spacecraft that is around Ceres is actually going to be closer. I think it's still getting closer to that.
Yeah, it's so cool to be exploring these objects. Now, they're both the same category now, dwarf planets that we never knew about. But to have this one planet, let's just for the sake of simplicity, we'll call Pluto a planet during this show, just to not having to qualify it all the time. To have known about it since 1930, you know, we're talking about 85 years, and not know anything about it. As you well know, Ray, we had visits by 4 spacecraft that went through the solar system. We had the two Pioneers, 10 and 11. We had the two Voyagers, 1 and 2, mm-hmm. both of which blasted off in 1977, visited Jupiter in 79, Saturn in 80 and 81, Uranus in 86, January 24th, 1986, Neptune in 89, and it could have gone to Pluto, too, because the planets were perfectly aligned to slingshot it onto Pluto.
Why did it not do that?
Because Congress, strangely enough, when it was launched, said, we're going to fund it to Neptune, and we're not going to fund the extra...
You're already out there. You might as well.
You're out there. So we missed that opportunity.
Oh,
and so we've waited since 1989, because at that time, Neptune and Pluto were the same distance away. We've waited from then till now to get our first look. So it's amazing to know about a celestial body, a planet at that time. And only now are we really going to find out about it. So we're so close for our first views. We're going to go from knowing nothing about it to crystal clear views.
Well, we'll have a crystal clear view, but how much will we know? For instance, Ceres, you have these bright spots.
Good
we
point.
Still don't know. And there's another thing on Ceres where it's pretty flat, and there's not a lot of bumps on this thing, and then there's a huge mountain, a pyramid-shaped mountain in the middle of this thing.
It's true. So the mysteries are never over. But, you know, we'll take the detail that we're going to see, because we certainly didn't know anything before. Still coming in every day. It's changing because the spacecraft's getting closer and closer. So July 14th, very exciting to be able to get that close. It's going to be only 7,750 miles above Pluto.
Wow, that's close.
Less than Earth's diameter.
Yeah.
So it's roughly one Earth diameter. It's going to skim over, and that's really close. So picture a spacecraft passing one Earth diameter above Earth and looking down with high-resolution cameras, and that's what we're going to have available.
That's exciting. But then, and we got to take a break here, but I want to ask you, what happens next for that spacecraft if it's going 8 miles a second and it's not stopping at Pluto because it can't? What's next? We'll take a break. 1-800-348-2551. And then Barry in Scotia, I promise, we'll get to your call right away. Once again, we got in the conversation and Barry is on hold. Barry, you're next.
Support comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. SPAC welcoming the New York City Ballet to their summer home for the 49th season. This year for 2 weeks, July 7th through July 18th, with Fidelity sponsoring Kids on the Lawn. SPAC.org for tickets. The Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, announcing their updated website with more information about membership, grants, and loans, so our past has a future, preserveNYS.org. The Honest Weight Food Co-op, 100 Watervliet Ave, Albany, New York, specializing in local and organic produce, natural groceries, fine cheeses, locally raised meats, and ready-to-go organic meals. HonestWeight.coop. George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts. Family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation, services, and deliveries. GeorgePropane.com. And the Hyde Collection, Glens Falls. This summer, featuring the later drawings of Andy Warhol, 1973 through 1987, organized by the Andy Warhol Museum, one of the Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh. HydeCollection.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. I'll tell you, Bob, you and I get talking, and then the listeners are on hold, and they hang up. Joan Marie in Smallwood had to hang up, wants to know how often and why Earth is slowing down around the sun. How does this affect timing on computers? Anything?
Timing on computers. We do slow down and speed up. In fact, we are now at our slowest point of the year, thanks to Kepler's second law, which shows us how planets speed up and slow down.
Yeah.
When we're closest to the sun, which is early in January every year, we're faster, as if we're being whipped around it. And when we're farthest from the sun, which is always around July 4th, we're at our slowest point in the orbit. And this has consequences because it means the sun seems to move slower against the background stars, and it changes our sundial time, how that corresponds to real time. So there are consequences. But for our computers, how does this affect our computers?
Yeah.
I can't think of any way Earth's orbital speed affects our computers.
Mm. Well, that's an interesting question. Maybe for the science forum. We'll see how that that plays out.
Now, I don't think there is a way Earth's speed affects our computers. How would it?
Well, I don't know. I'm a radio host. I could barely spell my name. Give me a break. Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. So just to wrap this up about Pluto, the New Horizons is going 8 miles a second. It's going to zip past Pluto. Its closest point is July 14th. What happens after it's past Pluto?
Oh, well, it can be reprogrammed. We're hoping to see some Kuiper Belt objects.
Of which Pluto is one.
Yep. Yep. So there's a repository of things that look like they could become comets if they were collided with each other and had some impetus and moved inward towards the inner solar system. And there's thousands of them, icy bodies, of which Pluto is one of the larger. We've got Quarar and Sedna and Eris and Makemake. There's a number of them. So as it heads outward, Hopefully we can pass another one or maybe even two.
Or hopefully not into one. That would not be good.
Yeah, although that would be nice and close, give us a lot of...
Right up to the fiery end. Yeah. That would be great. Let's go to Philip in Orange, Mass. Philip, you're on. Oh, let's hit the button, Ray. Jeez, what the heck's wrong with me? Philip, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, you're on.
I'm calling about the map of the solar system. When you look at it, it looks like all the planets are parallel. Are some of the planets above or lower than the plane of the Earth?
Yes. Compared to the Earth's flat plane around the sun, they only deviate by a few degrees. Pluto, that we were just talking about, had the greatest deviation. One of the many reasons it was demoted, because it was 17 degrees, but that's not much. When you think about the most something could deviate, which would be 90 degrees, unless you counted the direction that it's traveling. In that case, you could even make more of an orbital deviation. But Mercury is only 7 degrees off the plane. Venus, 3.4 degrees. The next several planets, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, less than 2.5 degrees. Uranus, 0.7. It's less than 1 degree from the orbital plane. So they're all within a few degrees.
Mostly higher?
No, there's no higher or lower, because they're just tilted relative to Earth's orbit. So that as we go around the sun, for half of our orbit, we'd see another planet's orbit above us. And then because it's inclined, for the other half of our orbit, we'd be staring towards the part of the orbit that's below us. See what I'm saying? Because they're all they're centered on the sun. So all the planets will take turns being above the Earth-Sun plane or the ecliptic plane, and then half the time below the ecliptic plane.
All right. Thanks a lot. That cleared a lot of things up in my mind.
Oh, sure.
Thanks, Philip. We appreciate the call. Now, is that standard sort of operating procedure for solar systems to have all the planets more or less in the same plane?
Yeah, we think so. That's been the case that we've seen with the extrasolar planets. There's 2,000 now extrasolar planets. In most cases, we only see one. So when you only see one,
you can't
compare it to the others. But from our theories of how a planetary system would start out, and to begin with, having a flat plane makes the most sense. So that's what happened to us. They all go around the same direction. If you're north of the solar system, all the planets are going around the sun counterclockwise.
Yeah.
They're all spinning on their axes in the same direction, too, with one major exception, which is Venus. But Venus almost doesn't even turn at all, so it doesn't count. The sun is rotating in the same direction. Asteroids are all going around the sun in the same direction. So it's really a one-way solar system.
Oh,
everything is going the same way. The one real exception are comets. Comets can come in any which way.
So this is a rant. We'll get to the next caller in a moment. This is a rant that came in via email from Jeff, who says, to mourn Pluto is understandable, but to try and obstruct science and progress because of selfish nostalgia is ignorant and small-minded. The people perpetrating this ridiculousness don't even bother to understand why or what we've learned. Neil deGrasse Tyson receives death threats to this day over this pseudo-controversy. Talk about a facepalm moment. Good grief. Jeff is upset about this.
Now, does Jeff, I didn't follow that, Ray. Was he upset because we've demoted it?
I believe that he's upset because people are upset about it.
Oh, I see. So he says, okay, we demoted it to a dwarf planet. We should live with it and stop complaining.
Exactly.
Okay.
In a nutshell. All right, let's go to Merle. Merle, you're on.
All right. This is just a follow-up question on the person that gave you that email about the Earth slowing down.
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, it was on the news, but it was yesterday, I think, on the 1st, that they added a second to our 24-hour day. In other words, we had 24 hours and 1 second, and they were saying that might mess up computers.
That's not us traveling around the sun, though.
That's a leap second.
That's a leap second. Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Okay, I got that. On the last day of December or June, that's when we will insert a leap second if it's needed. Now, for many of the past 10 years, it hasn't. And before that, they were needed a lot. There was even two that were inserted in 1972. And the reason for that, usually the news media get this wrong. They say it's because Earth is slowing down.
Right.
Okay?
That's what the woman said
now,
or what
you know,
or the email.
You know, it's true that we're slowing down, but do you know how slowly we're slowing down? Every 700 years, I'm sorry, every 700 centuries, it's a second. So it's
every 107
yes.
centuries.
Yeah, so it's almost nothing. And so that wouldn't be enough to make us have to add a leap second once a year or once every few years. The reason we add it is really, really interesting. And that's that way back in the 1830s or so, a day, a solar day really was 24 hours long. But since then, we've slowed down only a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. But in the 1950s, when we decided to sync up our clocks with atomic time, you know, we use...
Right. Exactly.
Right. You know, the cesium atom and atomic time because the nucleus of cesium atoms happens to vibrate. Do I still remember the number? 9,192,631,770 times per second.
I'll take your word for it.
That's how we defined a second. And then we defined the number of seconds in a day, and that was fine. But we used data that went back a century and a half. And so because of that, we defined the second and the day wrong.
Huh.
And it's because of the setup in the 1950s that we're out of sync with the spinning of the Earth. If we had only used the more modern data, we wouldn't have had to add leap seconds almost every year or every couple of years. We could have gone 30 years, 40 years before adding a leap second. So, yeah, Earth is slowing, but it's slowing so slowly that's a secondary reason.
So how does it mess up a computer?
Well, that's the question. Time? Now, would it mess up your computer? Now, the GPS satellites up at 22,300 miles, I'm sorry, they're up 11,000 miles. It's the geostationary satellites that are up at 22,000.
Right.
The GPS satellites have atomic clocks, and most of us get our time signals from either cell phones or other methods that are using atomic clocks. But the atomic clocks are synced up with this change in the leap seconds. So it should not affect you if you're using your cell phone or other way for time. But your computer doesn't do this. It doesn't resync itself to satellites. So I think that's what the news programs must have been talking about, that your computer might be off by 1 second, if you care.
Right. But they were saying that they were going to have to make some kind of adjustment to all computers. There's some scientific study is going to go on.
Okay.
At the end of the year or something.
Well, you know, that's another one we could probably bring up. Thanks, Merle. We'll probably bring that up on the Science Forum one of these days. Number to call here on Vox Pop is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Here is a question that came in via email, and this is probably right in your wheelhouse here, based on your work in The Sun's Heartbeat. Here's the question. I heard on Stardate, another program that WAMC airs regularly, about the Maunder Minimum, which you and I have talked about, a time of unusually few sunspots for several 11-year cycles, which coincided with a little ice age, a time of cooling temperatures in Europe in the late 1600s and early 1700s. Stardate speculated we might be entering into another Maunder Minimum, as the sunspot activity the last two cycles has not been active as normal. Boy, it has been low. Is there any correlation between Earth temperatures and sunspot activity? And if so, would lack of sunspot activity be any reprieve from global warming?
Yes. And that was in my last book, The Sun's Heartbeat.
Yeah.
We did a whole chapter on exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this person's right. There was a period of time. The Maunder Minimum was from 1645 to 1715. Coincided with the reign of Louis XIV.
Yes, it did.
The Sun King. We had an exact period where the Earth got cold, and there were icebergs further south than anyone had seen, and the Venice canals froze. It was a time of great hardship, and that's just when the sunspots all but stopped. Instead of having 11-year cycle of sunspots, there were no sunspots for a whole human lifetime, and so nobody knows why that happened. But since then, we've been keeping track of the sunspots. We're only in sunspot cycle number 24. But starting in about 1999 and 2000, the sun has been strangely quiet.
Yeah.
We had a long, instead of an 11-year cycle, it was a 14-year cycle of, we had a great minimum 2005, 2006, 2007, where for almost a year not one spot occurred. That was unusual. And now that we finally reached sunspot maximum last year going into this one, it was only half the height. I'm talking about in a graph.
You know,
half the number of sunspots we'd normally see. So between this deep and long minimum, this wimpy maximum, many solar astronomers, and I wrote that book 4 or 5 years ago, and even back then many astronomers were saying it, and everything we've seen since then only reinforces it, that the sun is entering, it seems, an extended period of quiet. Now, what does this do to us? We know that when the spots disappear, it definitely makes us colder. But even a normal sunspot minimum, we lose about 1 watt per cubic meter. In visible light, the average is 1,365 watts per square meter, almost a square yard. So if you're on the equator and you place, let's say, a poster-sized sheet on the ground, the sunlight that hits it will give you the brightness of 1,365 watts.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, like 1,300 watt light bulbs.
Yeah.
It loses 1 watt during the time of sunspot minimum. So it's not a lot on the visible spectrum, but it can lose fully 10% of its light in the ultraviolet. And so now we think that the ultraviolet affects the high atmosphere. It has trickle-down effects that are much more pervasive and affects us a lot more than just the visible light. So, yes, bottom line is the sun is kind of coming to a rescue. It's making global warming not warm as much. I wondered why this plateauing that we seem to have had since 1999, we have 16 or 17 years where the sunspot the heating of the Earth has been pretty flat.
Yeah.
We've not gone on, as you know, even though some recent evidence, some scientists are saying, well, no, that's because we didn't figure in this and this, but many of us aren't buying that. It's been warm, but it hasn't warmed up very much in 16, 17 years. Is this because of the sun's low activity? Is that tying it in? And there are those that are thinking that there's more of a tie-in than we think.
Well, I know that ham radio operators are lamenting the fact that the solar max didn't really happen, and so DX conditions, the ability to work your signal around the world based on the charge of the ionosphere, way down.
Yes,
some of the frequencies that these ham operators would use, which the more energized the ionosphere is, the higher and higher the frequency is, they're just not usable most of the time.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah.
So we really are in a period of decreased solar activity. And some think, just as this caller, I wasn't a caller, it was an emailer, suggested that maybe this is just the beginning of a even deeper period for the sun. And if we are entering another Maunder minimum, hey, it couldn't come at a better time because it's going to really help us in terms of global warming, if we could still use that term, because it'll have a cooling effect on the Earth. It'll counterbalance it to a great extent, if that's what's happening. And maybe it is, because the sun has been weird now for quite a while.
Bob Berman is our guest. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Now, the sun, you were on, I think, last year, and we talked about the sun reversing its poles, its north and south pole. That process is now done?
That process is done, yeah. That's what defines the beginning of a new sunspot cycle. So now that we're in cycle number 24, we're firmly in that. The polarity of the sunspots in the southern and the northern hemispheres of the sun are established. They're not changing. So we're firmly in that cycle. And the question is, what'll happen? You know, how it'll affect auroras. I care because we bring people up to secret places in Alaska every year to see the auroras, and we want the auroras to continue. We want a nice, vigorous sunspot cycle, and so we'll have to see. You know, the sun calls the shots on these things.
Indeed. And so it's too early to make a firm prediction that, in fact, we are entering one of these periods. It's just right now we're in a lull, right?
That's right.
So in the 50s, 60s, 70s, there was a lot of activity.
Yeah, we had very normal cycles. The one that peaked about 1998 was a nice normal sunspot cycle. It's this it was this last minimum that was deeper and longer than anyone alive has seen. Mm. And now it's been followed by a sunspot maximum. We're in sunspot maximum last year, and it was supposed to go into this one. And instead, it's been half the amount of solar activity. So, yeah, you know, the sun calls its own shots. You know, we have no control. We can only observe it. But more and more solar astronomers are getting on board this, hey, what's going on? It looks like the beginning of an extended period of time. And if so, the sun couldn't have picked a better time to do this, because just as we're hopefully switching to non-fossil fuels and, you know, hopefully put less carbon into the air, this is just the time when the sun has chosen to make Earth a little cooler.
Bob Berman is our guest. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Valley Home Improvement, designing and building kitchens, bathrooms, interiors, and additions throughout the Pioneer Valley. Love your home, valleyhomeimprovement.com. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to protect ecologically important lands and waters of the Adirondacks for nature and people. nature.org/Adirondacks. The Ashokan Center, a classroom in the wild where nature inspires conferences, festivals, family celebrations, and outdoor education for schools. AshokanCenter.org. Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche. QFCC.com. Windy Hollow Veterinary Clinic, Montague, Massachusetts. Conventional and integrative veterinary medicine, including acupuncture and chiropractic therapy. Comprehensive pet care and health services since 1998. WindyHollowVet.com. And Siegel Music Colony announcing the Patrice Munsell Gala, supporting the Young Artist Program on July 11th. SiegelColony.org for reservations.
Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman, astronomer extraordinaire, is our guest. And over to Matthew in Latham. Matthew, you're on.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Just wondering if the recent earthquakes over the last 10 years has tilted the Earth more on the axis, and is that possibly causing the global warming? And I'll take that answer off there.
All right, thanks, Matthew.
Well, you have a valid point in that the amount of tilt on an axis does affect seasons. Planets without tilt, Mercury has none, 1/20th of a degree. A 30th of a degree, nothing. Jupiter only has 3-degree tilt. When you have no tilt, you don't have seasons. And the planets with great tilts, let's say Uranus with a 98-degree tilt, has crazy seasons. So our tilt does change over time, but only by about a degree and a half. So we're at 23.5 degrees now. Now, does the tilt change? What really changes from earthquakes is the location of the poles by a few feet.
Why?
Because the actual spin, and you wouldn't think something near the surface of the Earth would affect Earth's huge mass that much, but it's enough, believe it or not, that's enough of a shift to produce a change in the rotation period, and we're talking about a fraction of a hundredth of a second. Our rotation period is 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4.1 seconds. So when you're talking about a fraction of a second, the tiniest fraction, and the location of the North and the South Pole, we have a shift of about 80 feet per year in where the poles
are
located.
The magnetic poles.
No, the actual physical pole of rotation. It shifts by about 80 feet per year and then back again, which in turn shifts the equator. That's why, you know, we were in Chile, in Ecuador, and people love to stand there with one foot in the northern hemisphere and one foot in the southern. People take their pictures because the equator line is drawn on the ground outside of Quito. But there is really no permanent equator line. If you want to draw a line, it would be as wide as an interstate highway, because in the course of the year, the poles shift by almost 100 feet, and so does the equator, where the equator is positioned. So there's always a shift. But when we have a big earthquake, there's like an additional shift of just a couple of feet.
Yeah.
So it's a minor thing, a minor change in Earth's rotation, as you'd expect, because all of this is just the topmost few miles of a giant planet that's 8,000 miles in diameter. So you would expect not too much of a change, and that's just what you get.
All right, let's go over to Dean in Munson, Massachusetts. Dean, you're on.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to, getting back to the satellite that's approaching Pluto, there can't be much of a signal left. Do you know how much, what the strength of the signal is and how long it takes to get back to us?
It takes 4.5 hours to get back. And as for the strength, fortunately, it uses RTGs, which are radioisotope thermoelectric generators. It's much too dark out there. At Pluto's distance, the sun is 1,600 times fainter than it is here. How did I do that? Well, Pluto's average distance is 40 Earth-Sun distances. The sun's intensity falls off with the square of the distance, so you do 40 times 40 is 1,600.
Oh, fair enough.
So you can't use solar panels. So what we did is the same thing we used for the Cassini mission to Saturn and the Galileo mission to Jupiter and all of our Mars probes. You use the wonderful fact that plutonium, the heat from plutonium can be converted directly to electricity, and these last forever. For example, the Voyager spacecraft that are now in the leaving the solar system entirely and which took off in 1977, they're still sending back signals thanks to these RTGs.
Yeah.
Now, it sounds like I'm crazy pro-plutonium here, but, man, that's a great power source. So that's what the New Horizons is using. And
well, that's great. Now, I thought there was a moratorium for a time on putting up spaceships with radioactive
power
sources.
No, they tried. There were people who tried to stop even Cassini from launching with that. And that's one of the reasons the Philae lander and the Rosetta mission to the comet recently, that used solar cells. And that's one reason why the Philae lander was screwed. Am I allowed to say that on the
air? Well, you just did, Bob.
Because it landed in the shadow. You know, it landed in a place we didn't expect. It had shadow, so it didn't have sunlight, so it didn't have power. And that was the end of the mission for almost half a year.
Yeah.
So. But instead, no, this one's has a power source that's going to last for decades.
All right, Dean, thank you so much for the call. Over to Jim in Adams, Mass. Jim, you're on.
Good afternoon. Hey, Ray.
Hey.
I did have a question. I should have thought of it before. A friend of mine used to theorize years ago that all the barrels and barrels and barrels and barrels of petroleum oil that have been extracted from the earth has, and they've been burned up, so now they're converted from the liquid weight they were in the soil into gaseous forms over the Earth's atmosphere. But that shifting of weight, he theorized, might that extraction of weight from the different areas of the Earth might shift our axis of the Earth?
I think it would shift the axis. When you're thinking of removing the that much weight, you could shift the change the rotation.
Mm-hmm.
In a minuscule way, but
right.
Just think of the weight of the Earth, which
mm-hmm.
is 4 followed by 27 zeros
mm-hmm.
Tons. That's a nonillion, 4 nonillion tons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so even that amount of weight that you're talking about with the petroleum is still kind of negligible. We come across this with the sun. Like the sun is losing 4 million tons of its mass every second.
Yeah.
4 million tons a second.
Wow.
And that's not theoretical. If you could weigh the sun on a giant scale, the sun actually is 4 million tons lighter every second. So you'd think, whoa, it's going to be gone soon and it's going to change itself. But the sun weighs so much, weighs 333,000 times than the figure I just gave you for Earth,
mm-hmm.
that it turns out it's going to be 5 billion years before there's any effect at all on the sun, even though it's 4 million tons a second.
Yeah.
So when you have that much mass, even though it sounds like a lot, it really is not a noticeable effect.
All right,
okay.
Jim, you got a follow up there?
Yeah, the original question I called in was if Bob Berman could run down a list of you know, major astronomical events like eclipses, solar, lunar, comets, meteor showers.
Okay, cool. We have the best meteor shower in years coming up on two nights, you know, the famous Perseid summer meteors, normally on the night of August 11th to 12th, but this year it's going to be almost equal on two nights, and this year there's going to be no moon interfering. So because of that,
August.
I know August 11th to 12th, and again the following night, August 12th to 13th. At Mohawk Mountain House, for example, here in our listening area, there'd be a special night of the shooting stars celebration for it. This is going to be a big thing. And a major event. So if we get clear skies, and we have two chances for it this year, those should be fabulous meteors this year.
Okay.
Then to the 12th to the 13th.
Then we have a total lunar eclipse in September. Is it September 27th or September 23rd? Late September.
I marked it before. I don't know who I marked it from. Maybe you. September 28th.
Okay. That's the night of the one to the other. Then we have a second great meteor shower that may even be better. That is on the night of December 13th. The Gemini meteor 13th. That also has no moon.
Oh,
to interfere.
Fantastic.
December 13th?
That's right. The night of the 13th to the 14th.
Nice.
And that's a meteor shower you don't have to stay up past midnight for. It'll be getting going after 8 p.m. or so.
And it'll be dark. Yeah. Great.
And rather than go on and on, I'll just tell you one thing to mark on the calendar, because you really want to be set up for that. And that's the first total solar eclipse in the United States for 38 years. And that will happen on August 21st, 2 years from now, in 2017. It'll be a coast-to-coast totality. That doesn't mean it'll be total from, let's say, Albany. It won't.
Yep.
But if you're anywhere on a 100-mile-wide line that runs from the Pacific Northwest right through the southeastern states, passing over places like Jackson, Wyoming, and St. Louis and a few other places, Nashville, definitely...
2017.
Yeah, 2017. Okay. August 21st.
Jim,
you can use the balding glasses shade.
Exactly, but you don't
shade
need
12 to.
Exactly, good for you. Yes, exactly. Shade 12 or 14 welder's goggles to see the partial phases, but for the total part, you don't need any protection at all. You could even point binoculars at it, and it's beautiful. Unprotected when it's total.
You got to be careful, though.
No. When it's totally eclipsed.
But I mean, what if you're wrong and it's not a total eclipse?
Well, you'll know it's total. The stars are out. The atmosphere of the sun, the corona is spread across the sky. You could not mistake totality from non-totality.
I wouldn't risk it, man. I wouldn't risk it.
You have to risk it.
All right, Sandy in Mount Washington, you're on. Sandy.
Hey Ray, how you doing?
Good.
Hey Bob, I heard something earlier in the year about some kind of a burst of radio waves on, I think, May 14th last year that I just heard briefly. It sounded interesting. I never heard more. Do you know anything about that?
Are you talking about a gamma ray burst, a GRB?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We used to detect these about less often. There was one major one a year. Now they're being detected because we're looking for them far more often. And they seem to be the most powerful events in the universe. And thanks to the work of Bodin Pazinski, I always mispronounce his last name, of Princeton, just passed away a few years ago, he determined that these were outside of our galaxy. So apparently other galaxies have these enigmatic giant explosions that most of which don't correspond with anything visible. We only detect it with our gamma ray telescopes, and these bursts only last a day or so, and during that time, the object gives off more energy than the sun has given off in its entire lifetime. So they're super energetic, amazing things, these GRBs. So, yeah, there was one a few months ago.
I mean, and we don't know too much about them, obviously.
Yeah, they're still a little mysterious. We're slowly learning more, and I don't want to say anything that may be mistaken, and I haven't lately caught up with the latest thinking on them, so I'll leave it at that.
I won't hold you to it. Now, once, years ago, there was a ring around the moon, I think this was 78, but there were little slash marks, demarcation, top, bottom, side. Have you seen that?
A ring around the moon with demarcations?
So
like
ice crystals?
Well, but in other words, it was like of the moon, the zenith, and it like straight up in the ring at the top, then on the bottom, and then on either side, you know, 90 degrees from each other.
That's really strange. I can tell you what I think you saw. The halo around the moon, it's always a halo. It's always the same size, 22 degrees.
Right.
If the moon is very bright, like near full, you might see a little red on the inside of the halo. The diameter, since it's always the same, is the same. This is fabulous. As an outstretched hand where you've spread apart your pinky and your thumb as far apart as they can be. Just spread your hand as far away from you. Close one eye. And if you put one of those, let's say the thumb tip, on the moon, the other thing, the pinky tip, will show you the radius, will be on the halo. So it's very cool. They're always the same size.
Right.
And again, they're caused by ice crystals, as Ray just mentioned, six-sided ice crystals. As for any markings on them, in the daytime, you can start to get some interesting refraction effects.
Right.
At the nighttime, usually that's about what you're going to get, unless the clouds causing them have breaks in them, and then there can be...
It was fascinating. Like a little slash mark, the one above and below were vertical, and the ones on the side were horizontal. In other words,
interesting.
Crossing the ring, you know.
I wish you'd taken a picture.
Oh,
well, thanks, Sandy.
All right, thanks, you guys. Great show, thanks.
Appreciate the call.
Thanks, man. Bye.
Yeah, you know, those ice crystals, the halos around the moon, and again, I don't know if this is true or not, but when I was a kid, we'd see that at night. We'd say, well, we're not going to have school tomorrow. It's going to snow.
You're so, there's truth to that, because the first sign of a coming weather system are the high clouds, and then come the middle-level clouds, and then come the lower clouds. So the high clouds come first, and the high clouds are ice crystal clouds.
Yeah.
So, yes, they are usually harbingers of bad weather. However, sometimes we get brushed by a passing system, and so we do get that, but then it never develops into the lower clouds.
Yeah, that probably happened. I'm sure I have forgotten all about that. I'm sure that happened more often than not. You know, disappointment I forget about. Frank and Colony. Frank, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I have this theory I want to throw at you. I feel that over the generations, I think we've actually, I sense there's actually a diminished interest in studying astronomy and space in general, because over the generations, we've increased the amount of light pollution that's bleached out the Milky Way galaxy. I'd like you to comment on that.
Losing the Milky Way is a terrible thing, and I know a few years ago we crossed a threshold on Earth that got a lot of publicity, where half the people on the planet now live in cities. So compared to, let's say, a century ago when it was still an agrarian, rural world, you're right, that's a huge difference between then and now. And the Milky Way is so beautiful. Now, particularly coming up in August through November, which is when it crosses the sky, splits the sky from north to south. But if you can get to a place where the Milky Way is prominent, and many of us in our listening area have that, because this is largely a rural area, on a night when the moon is not out, it's one of the most gorgeous things in the sky, that light of the Milky Way. It dominates the sky. For some cultures like the Incas and the Maya as well, it was the center of Earth and heaven, and you could see why people would do that. And as you've said, it has not been seen from big cities now for at least 75 years, so that urbanites don't even know the Milky Way. And if they get away, let's say, to the brighter suburbs or even the dimmer suburbs, there's a little trace of it, but the full glory of it, the way you could get, let's say, in the Adirondacks or in the Atacama Desert of Chile or in the really dark places, just takes your breath away. I think the Milky Way is right up there with the great spectacles of nature.
Frank, thank you very much. All right, we only have about 15 seconds here, but this is Maxine from email. Hi, Bob and Ray. Will our area see any of the eclipse in August?
No.
No? Okay. So that you got to wait. We'll see part of it in 2017, right?
Now, we're talking about, she's probably talking about the August 21st, 2017 eclipse, because that's the solar eclipse we were just mentioning it.
Yeah, but she emailed
before
that.
We will not get totality here at all.
Okay.
The nearest place to it will be over Tennessee and the Carolinas. It'll be a partial eclipse, but I hope nobody is suckered into staying home and just using filters and looking at the partial eclipse when you can get totality with just getting in your car and driving.
All right, Bob Berman, thank you so much for being here today. Thanks to everybody who called in. Support comes from the Center for Extended Care on University Drive in Amherst, a family-owned and operated nursing center offering rehab, long-term care, and Alzheimer's specialty care, CECAA.com. Albany Realty Group, a local woman-owned real estate company since 2003, educating and counseling sellers and buyers throughout the real estate transaction, albanyrealtygroup.com. Larrack, serving the arts community year-round in downtown Glens Falls since 1972, with gallery exhibits and gift shop featuring handmade items by regional artists, larac.org. And Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors, serving the Northeast since 2001, stonesoupconcrete.com, and on Facebook. Well, that's it. We're out of time. Thanks to Bob Berman. Thanks to Zach, our engineer. Thanks to Deb Malik, who answered our calls today. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's a holiday. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be back on Monday with Medical Monday. Stay tuned now for the news.